Saving money on your next project now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today, in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 499.1C1111, certificate number 36926. Free to be you and me.
And you and me are free to be.
And you and me are free to be. You and me.
Oh, even the way you said it.
Gen X is just filled with little warm, joyful shivers right now.
What's crazy is that we've never done Free to Be You and Me on this show.
We just talked about it on 700 other shows.
Yeah, and I realized because this is a John show, a thing that a lot of people have indicated they're interested in.
Of all the things you could talk about, you haven't done one of these in months, and you want it to be about... like a 1970s TV special.
I looked at all of my old shows, you know, the show list that you and I both maintained. We had a shared one, which I never looked at. And then, you had one and I had one.
On my phone.
And I was like, okay, well, there's a lot of shows here about missiles. And
that's what people already do, right? When you have them on, they're like, John wants missile shows.
Yeah, they're like, oh, I've got another show about a railroad. And I looked at all of them, and then I was like, wait a minute. You know, I'm just going to do like a warm, fuzzy show about a thing that maybe... I just rewatched it.
Oh, you did? I was going to ask.
I rewatched Free to Be You and
How?
Me.
How does one watch it? Is it streaming?
Yeah, you can watch it on your phone right now. It's only 40 minutes long.
Does that mean it's on YouTube, or does that mean somebody actually has the rights?
I think it's on YouTube. It was broadcast, you know, on HBO. I mean, I think it's never been, the record's never been out of print. The book's never been out of print.
It's not streaming.
It's not. So it was YouTube.
Yeah, it just means you found an online video. I think we had it on VHS when I was a kid, and I saw it on, I believe, what would a projector in my kindergarten class have been? Were there 8mm?
An 8mm projector on a cart.
It is my primal memory of watching something from a cart and just being gobsmacked. And like to this day, I remember like the emotional impact of that. And I'm not sure if it's because I'm seeing a movie in school, something that I had never imagined.
Right.
Or if it's because I was in kindergarten. Or if it actually was like... just something about the music, the animation with the horses at the beginning. Like, it really is like, you're seeing something great, Gen X. You've never seen this before.
Well, what is very interesting about Free to Be You and Me, to me, is that I'm exactly the age that was sitting in front of the television when it was originally broadcast.
Network? Was it an after-school
thing?
Yeah,
it was on ABC. And it wasn't after school. It was prime time
special.
And so I was 5 and a half.
And were you already a TV watcher? Was this interrupting Happy Days?
Well, if you remember, Sesame Street started in 1969, and I was 1 year old. And my mom tells the story that I was sitting there in my high chair with my little thing of applesauce and watched the first Sesame Street. So I was very much a Sesame Street, like raised on Sesame Street. And by the time you're 5 and a half, you are, I mean, because I started school late, I was already through first grade, right? First grade?
Five and a half? No, you were
kindergarten.
I was still being kindergarten.
I was about to, so it aired in March. So I was at the end of kindergarten.
So you and I both saw it in kindergarten. Yeah. It's just that I saw it tape delayed on,
on
a spool of film.
Whereas I was sitting crisscross applesauce in front of our giant console television that had a record player in one end and record storage in the other. And, you know, one of those color TVs, but where it was kind of flickery, it was already 5 years old. And it hit me like a ton of bricks, but because I was primed for it, you know, this was Sesame Street on steroids in a way.
A lot of the framing thing with the puppets is very Muppet reminiscent, even though Henson had nothing to do with it.
And a lot of the songs had kind of Sesame Street-y energy.
The big 70s celebrities, the same way you would see Carol Channing show up on Sesame Street, well, here she is on Free to Be You and Me.
Yep. And also, a lot of it set in Manhattan, or maybe all of it set in Manhattan, and with a very diverse cast, which was... being in Alaska or Seattle in 1973-74, diverse cast isn't exactly how you would have described my elementary school.
Sesame Street, yeah, it's really understated how it kind of just normalized brownstones and kids playing stickball.
Yeah.
And I think at the time people noticed this. Like normally you would watch a kid show and it would be a farm or something. And this was the crazy high concept thing was, what if these kids were in a city? Because you know who needs literacy and education is kids in the cities, and we want them to see their environment. But like for us suburban kids, it was also huge because that just normalized that kind of, my default idea of childhood is kids playing with a hydrant in the Sesame Street credits, a thing that I've never seen in real life.
Yeah, me too. And I think the premise of Sesame Street was, as you say, it's the kids in the city, the poor kids, really, that are not going to get access to Montessori education. And that's, and this is maybe the first nationwide public television show that's going to try and incorporate those kids.
It's not just that there's going to be one black kid in the crowd like there would have been on some other earlier show. It's like the default view of the show is the kids of New York City who are black and brown and everything else.
And like you say, I had never seen a concrete jungle. I had never seen a housing project or a brownstone or kids playing in a fire hydrant. Or if you look at in fact, I have the pictures right there. If you look at my kindergarten class, there are no people of color except for one Italian kid.
Really?
Who stands out. And I think later on there were some Asian kids, and by some I mean one, in my class. But to watch Sesame Street was to be introduced to very much another universe from the one I was in.
I saw it young enough, and maybe you did too, that I just assumed that was the default universe. You know, it wasn't just like, oh, interesting, there's diversity on Sesame Street.
What's crazy about Free to Be You and Me, if you watch it now, there are things that we would look at and think...
It looks like there's stuff in there that seems like performatively woke leftism, even by today's standards.
There's that, but there's also some things that by today's standards, it's very gender normative in the sense mm-hmm. that there are only two genders.
Yes.
There are no gay characters.
It's actually a little bit reductive through modern eyes to be like, hey, ladies can be construction workers too.
That and just seems like, then they're going to get married.
Yeah.
And, you know, moms can be construction workers. And dads are dads.
And part of it is that it's Marlo Thomas, who is, you know, I mean, extremely wife-coded.
Yeah, and even then, 35.
Yeah.
Right? She was born in 37. So she's just a little bit younger than my mom.
Also, but, I had the hugest crush on her. I think that's I think that's part of Gen X's Free to Be You and Me fascination is that the boys, like the Marlo Thomas is a stone fox.
But there's also a scene in the show where she is sitting kind of with like not a bouffant exactly, but definitely not a hippie haircut. Like a
like she's
a,
permed?
It's sprayed up. It still kind of has a 60s go-go boots look. But she's sitting, just talking candidly to a group of kids.
I can picture it right now. Yeah,
a group of 5
years. I know every segment of Free to Be You.
And she's like, "How do you like your brother? You know, do you ever tell your sister that you love her?" And the way she's talking to the kids, it just feels like the kind of like feminist mom that you trusted, that you loved. She was so gentle. She was so personable. I remember watching her as a kid and just being like, wow.
She didn't and doesn't have kids. She has Phil Donahue's
Five sons that she raised.
Phil Donahue's 5 large sons who all look like Phil Donahue with the hair and the glasses. No, I don't know. Wouldn't that be great if they were just different sizes, but they all looked like Phil Donahue?
I've never seen a picture of Phil Donahue's 5 sons, but I can only imagine. But so Marlo Thomas was already a real fixture in the American cultural scene, and it started when she was just a kid. Her father was Danny Thomas, beloved star of stage and screen.
Was she a child actor? I'd never saw her before That Girl.
No, but she was like a young actress. I mean, even by the time of That Girl, she was 30. But she appeared in a lot of Broadway shows. She was a guest on Bonanza, kind of one of these things where she was a nepo baby, but also a talent.
She was in the London Barefoot in the Park. Elizabeth Ashley did not do the London production.
Right.
Oh, that's interesting.
So she was a contender in Broadway. And so by the time That Girl got pitched, and you know, That Girl was a television show about a single woman living in the city, or a young single gal living in the city.
It beat Mary Tyler Moore to market, I think. Right?
Yeah. And it was when the original pitch went to the network, they were like, who would want to watch a show about an unmarried girl living in the city? Like, how boring is that?
Today it's like the definition of what people would want. It's like, it's synonymous with adulthood and glamour. And at the time they're like,
And it was a very popular show. It ran for 7 years, I think. Well, no, I'm sorry. It ran for 5 years. It was from 66 to 71. But if you think about 1966, like it's a pretty exciting time, but it's before the Summer of Love. It's also before hippies, really. It's before feminism became a national movement. It was, all that stuff was nascent. It was bubbling up, but That Girl is wearing go-go boots. I mean, she's a cute girl.
Even though she's, going to the office.
Going to the office. And she has a boyfriend. The show never shows them spend the night together, or I think even imply. But
she's not that girl.
But no. But Marlo Thomas took a very active role in the in the vibes of the show, in the themes of the show. And as time went on, she had a lot of say in how That Girl portrayed her That Girlness.
Soft power, right? She back then she would not have had any kind of producer credit or anything. She would, her influence is all just, the culture of the show.
Except by the end, she is the star, right? And she is, they can't make the show without her.
Yeah, so she's got that.
And for the final episode, the show was, its primary sponsor was Clairol. So Clairol had a lot of, and these are the Mad Men days, right? So Clairol is meeting in a meeting room and saying, okay, for the grand finale, she's going to marry her boyfriend and move out to the suburbs.
It's a happy ending since Shakespeare.
Happy ending. And Marlo Thomas said, no, that would betray to my entire audience. It would betray the idea that a single woman could live in the city and be a be an interesting and viable person all by herself without a man. I'm not going to marry her off. And it was really a contention between, you know, the sponsors.
Sponsor had a lot of leverage back then.
It did. And in the end, the final episode, she takes her boyfriend to a women's lib meeting.
That's instead of the wedding?
Instead of the wedding.
It's a second wave feminism?
And according to her, it satisfied no one. It made no, it didn't make her audience happy. It didn't make anybody happy. But that was her, like,
she was creatively happy.
Her big thing. And what's interesting is I always, and this is maybe just like, kind of you absorb it through the culture. I always put Danny Thomas in the larger group of kind of Jewish comedians because Thomas feels like one of these Ellis Island names that you would adopt as a way of, you know,
well, just because every other comedy leading man of the time on TV was,
and sort of dark, complected, and with that sense of humor. But Danny Thomas is actually
Lebanese
and Lebanese Catholic. And her mother
Amos Muziad Yaqub Kairouz.
Yes. Her mother is Sicilian.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So she was, so Danny Thomas, you know, he became in some ways even more famous for starting St. Jude's, the Catholic Children's Research Hospital. And so Marlo Thomas was coming from, you know, a very different side of Hollywood showbiz.
Yeah, because right? St. Jude is in like...
It's in Memphis. Yeah.
But the Thomases didn't have any connection to Memphis?
No, or? I think Memphis just was a place where it seemed like they could use St. Jude's. And St. Jude's, I mean, Marlo herself became St. Jude's biggest booster.
Yeah. I saw her in ads for St. Jude's most of my life.
Yeah, me too.
Hey, John.
Hey, it's Manager Grant. How are you, Grant?
I'm good. How you doing?
So good. So relaxed. And
are you hot down there? It's that, you know, we have this unseasonably hot June here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, today is a warm day. In fact, I was going to work in the garden, but it's too hot. Too hot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how about sleeping? Do you ever feel super sticky in the hot early evening or even in the morning when you've been sleeping for a while?
Well, you know, we don't have air conditioning here in the Northwest.
No.
Although that's probably going to have to change. Do you have air conditioning?
You know, I do. I got a heat pump a couple years ago, which was unfortunately felt like a necessary thing to have nowadays.
Yeah, smart move. I do not. And so, yeah, even with the windows open, I do get hot in bed and I end up just sleeping only with a sheet, no blanket.
Well, what kind of sheets are you using there over there at the bunker?
Well, interestingly, you should ask, Grant. I have been fortunate enough to have Miracle Made sheets. I don't know if I've told you about Miracle Made, but they are sheets that are silver infused and temperature regulating.
Oh, man. That sounds like some space age technology.
Well, it really is. Miracle Made sheets are using NASA developed technology that not only keep you warm in winter and cool in summer, but they actually prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, which is what gives you like the itchies and the rashies.
Yeah. Thank God for NASA.
Well, thank God for Miracle Made. You know, they stay clean longer and they feel very luxurious, but without the luxury price. Actually, Grant, you know, I would like you to experience the comfort and cleanliness of Miracle Made sheets. I'm going to give you this opportunity by saying, go to trymiracle.com. And since you're a friend, you just put /omnibus on there.
I am a friend.
And that's right. You're in on this. I'm going to give you this inside deal. You're going to get Miracle Made sheets and save over 40%. And if you use the promo code Omnibus, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set.
That's a good deal.
It's not just a good deal. It's a great gift. You know, it makes a marvelous 4th of July gift. It makes a great Labor Day gift. So go to trymiracle.com/omnibusgrant. Use the code Omnibus at checkout, and you'll get a free three-piece towel set, 20% off the normal 40% off, and it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's trymiracle.com/omnibus. Marlo Thomas, although a great name, her actual name is Margaret, and her younger siblings couldn't pronounce Margot.
Did Marlo not exist as a man or woman's name?
I think Marlowe was a man's name.
For Christopher Marlo.
But Marlo with an O, she's the earliest and maybe only exemplar.
Yeah, I can't think of other...
After That Girl ended in 71, she was a big star. And she was going back to Broadway. She was transitioning to making movies. She was doing what you would expect in 1971. But the world had really changed by 1971. Have you been watching the documentary series on 1971, the year that changed music?
No.
It's a really, I don't remember which of the streaming services it's on, but it's a series of episodes talking about all the different music that came out in 1971.
I was listening to a lot of Neil Young in the car last week in the Dakotas, so I'm sure I'm...
Well, and what's nuts about it is you watch this series, it's 5 or 6 episodes, and you get to the end and you're... At least my experience was, you didn't even touch on the music of 1971. Like, they talk about it all, but they don't talk about Black Sabbath. They don't talk about Cat Stevens. You know, they're talking about Elton John, or they talk about soul music in the period. But there's so much else, you know, that happened in that year. A real transition that we don't often think of it as being a pivot point. We think of 1968, you think of 76.
Sure.
But so much changed then, and it was what we think of as, or you can trace a lot of what became second wave feminism to 71.
How so?
Like, 71 was the genesis of a lot of things that started to kind of trickle out in the early 70s. Ms. Magazine and Gloria Steinem were, although Ms. didn't come out until 72, like, they were, Gloria Steinem was becoming a public figure.
There was a preview sample in December 71 in New York Magazine. How about that?
There was just the energy around the idea, the premise of second wave feminism, which is a woman can do anything a man can do, was like a product of, it was like not a hangover of the 60s, but it was the logical conclusion of a lot of the civil rights movements of the 60s.
And I guess technological advances, if you think about the pill in 1960, powering a lot of, potential challenges to the social order that could not have happened before.
And I think also, and we don't talk about this a lot, but the decline of American manufacturing as the soul of the family unit,
right,
where dad worked in the factory and mom worked at home.
If everybody's in an office,
right,
it's hard to say, well, that should clearly just be men.
Right. The creative economy and people who are working in finance and in the creative arts, like, there isn't anything in special about men. And this was also a time when colleges were starting to open up. When did Yale admit its first woman?
I grew up in a world where you would still call female college students co-eds, which is so funny.
Yeah.
Fall of 69.
Yale started, you know, admitting women in 69, right? So,
so crazy.
I know, right? Like, I had cousins. The only people in my family that ever went to Yale other than my uncle are three of my female cousins. And the oldest of them started at Yale as freshmen when the seniors were part of that original class.
Interesting.
So they... You know, they had that, like, first...
They were the first integrated cohort. Yale. Yeah. Yeah, like, there were no all-male classes ahead of them when they got in.
If you can imagine, right? So yeah, it was, if you'll pardon the expression, a pregnant time in American gender relations. And it was when we were, or you weren't born yet, but when I was starting in school. And so I had the female teachers that I had as a kindergartner, first grader, second grader, were, they had big sprayed hair. You know, they were wearing bouffants, not bouffants. What are they called? Backcombed, like tall hair.
Were they old or young?
Well, my kindergarten teacher was young, Mrs. Christ. And although she was sort of go-go boots, she was progressive. And my mom was very feminist at that period. And Sesame Street was feminist. And so there was never a time in my life where I didn't understand that a woman could do anything a man could do. That being the standard of what was considered equality, that a black person could do anything a white person could do, and a woman could do anything that a man could do. Those now feel a little bit like kind of limited,
like training wheels.
Yeah, a little bit of a small view of what we're looking for when we talk about civil rights or equity or shared rights.
But still revolutionary then.
Revolutionary. Absolutely. Just like there were a lot of people who disagreed. And I think there are still a lot of people that disagree. This is part of the weird bro manosphere world where there's now a tremendous pushback on like, which men can do man.
And
things.
It felt like for decades there wasn't any pushback. I didn't realize that was a pendulum that could even come back, that at some point the pendulum would be, and of course your wife should be sitting at home darning your socks. Like
that was not, I did not see present. That coming. No, yeah. That was not present, at least in the
It
United
wasn't just
States.
That I was losing, that it was like it didn't exist.
It was utterly gone unless you were a member of a weird cult.
Exactly.
But what happened in the 70s, and maybe during this same period, was there was a co-theme that said, women are different than men, and what the world needs is that. Not that women can do anything that men can do, but that men
should be learning.
Yeah, men are kind of the problem because they see the world as only encompassing skills that are unique to them. And so women aren't just trying to be construction workers. They're trying to bring into government and into corporate life qualities that women possess that are absent. And that's why corporations aren't humane. And it's why it's why armies tend to pursue war. This was the theme or the philosophy. Now, whether or not it's panned out.
I bet it started with World War II with if the moms ran the world. Do you remember this kind of stuff, mid-century? Mm-hmm. If the moms ran the world, we wouldn't be fighting in Korea. You know, if the moms could just talk to each other, we wouldn't have Vietnam. And I think...
The moms talk to each other now, and we still have Vietnam.
We found something worse. But it is very much like there's stuff in Free to Be You and Me that absolutely would reflect today's talking points about how, well, like, masculinity can be toxic, you know? Here's Rosie Grier. Here's Alan Alda. Like,
and that's, I think, what's incredible about it in terms of if you haven't seen this, if you're younger than we are, if it wasn't part of your schooling, it's easy, and I think we see this a lot on social media, and it's one of the things that liberal Gen X gets so up in their britches about, is that most of these ideas existed in our lives in 1975. You know, it was, we were already very, very much talking about equity, gender equality, toxic masculinity.
Mr. Rogers was telling us that, you know, you shouldn't be afraid to cry. You should express your feelings. Somebody made fun of this guy because he took ballet lessons, but they shouldn't have because now he's a running back. Like,
that's right.
Like this was just into our veins.
And it's very easy to look at Free to Be You and Me and nitpick it on the fact that there aren't any trans people in it. But in terms of it being...
One star.
In terms of it being a product of its time, its genesis was that Marlo Thomas was talking to her sister about her niece, Dion, her sister's daughter.
Okay.
And wanting her to grow up in a world where she didn't have to spend 30 years developing an identity as an empowered woman.
Because Marla's remembering her own
journey, life. And yeah. All of her friends, right? They all are 30 years old, and it took them that whole time to say, wait a minute, I can do anything a man can do. And of course, this was what my mom wanted for me, right? She wanted me to be raised in a world where I was a good ally. And that wasn't the word that she would have used. But she believed, as I think we continue to believe, that if you raise a young man with the idea that women are his peers and equals and partners, and not that women are subservient or are different even.
Yeah, not a second category.
Then what you'll be creating is a world where that equality and that equity is just baked in and no one ever second guesses it. And I think we did think that's what had happened.
It seemed like it had happened, yeah.
Right? My generation, there wasn't going to be, I mean, in my high school class, there was no question that the kids that ran student government and the people that were smartest and going to the best colleges were all the girls, and the guys were always just, you know, playing catch up. And it wasn't,
there was no panic about it.
There was no problem.
The way I think we now are told to remember, like, men are endangered in a college campuses.
No, it was like, thank God the girls are running student Congress. They do such a much better job, but it wasn't a threat to the boys.
Right.
Right? The boys were like, yeah, and we're the, and there was, it wasn't, there wasn't toxicity in it.
There wasn't even the boy, we're the dumb sitcom husbands, even.
No, we didn't have that.
Like either. That, yeah, that dynamic. I mean, maybe you could argue that it was a kind of a offshoot of that, but
I think that there was some of this sense of like, well, actually, the women are better at running student Congress, but when it comes to doing business, the kind of cutthroatness of it, the hard edge you have to take if you're going to be successful in business was a thing that was better for boys.
And I wasn't aware of all the soft barriers. Like, you know, like for the first few decades of my life, there were, you know, so many things keeping women out of boardrooms and away from promotions. And I think I was still kind of in the sunny meadows of Free to Be You and Me.
But what Marlo Thomas realized, she started to read a book to her niece, Dion, that was called I'm Glad I'm a Boy, I'm Glad I'm a Girl. And it was written by a New Yorker cartoonist named Whitney Darrow Jr., who was, despite being named Whitney, a boy.
That used to be a man's name.
It was a man's name. And he was an old-timey New Yorker cartoonist. One of the first generation, you know, he started at the New Yorker in the 20s.
Oh, I know his work.
Yeah. And he's great, but this was a book of ye olden times where on one page, I mean, she recounts reading this and he's drawing the cartoons, right?
It's for children. This is not an adult humor book.
This is a book for kids. This is like a Silverstein style. Like I'm a New Yorker cartoonist, but I'm going to write books for kids.
Yeah, like Sid Hoff.
And the page that stuck out to Ms. Thomas was, boys are pilots, girls are stewardesses. It was one of these, like, boys work in a house, or girls are bakers.
But not with any ideology in mind. Just let's learn about the world, and here are some fun pictures.
Yeah.
And but she it really was like, there are boy jobs and girl jobs.
From her standpoint, this was exactly the kind of appalling thing that she read as a little girl that took her decades to debunk in herself. And she said, why don't we make a new culture where little girls are taught from a very young age that they can do whatever they want, and this will be these will be the new children's books, this will be the new content for this world that is inevitable. The world that we are the pioneers of. But it needs a new canon.
Yeah.
And so she set to work, and she recorded, because she was famous and was, and had power in the industry, she put together a group to make an album, which people listening to the show who are younger than 55 will not believe that an album, it was the primary way to reach the the largest possible audience.
And this is true. Outside of rock music, the album was an art form.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of our greatest musicals of that time started out as concept albums. You would buy a rock opera in album form, and then only then would it become Jesus Christ Superstar.
That's right.
Or whatever.
And over there in my record collection, I have probably a dozen 50s and 60s albums that are sketches.
Yeah, you could get Bob Newhart doing jokes, but you could also get
Nichols and May.
Yeah, or James Earl Jones reading
if you include those, I've got 50 over there.
Like the album was just the form of all kinds of, you know, it's kind of what became television.
Yes.
Like you or radio, you know. Anytime somebody talking is content, what if it were a record?
So she puts together a team, Carol Hart and her husband are both early Sesame Street creators. She gets Alan Alda, who we think of as only being a 70s star, but Alan Alda was a star of Broadway.
Yes.
He all through the 60s.
Her pure, and they're both Nepo babies. They're both sons of actors of the previous generation.
Right.
Or sorry, son, children of.
And she puts together a cast to make a record album of skits and songs written by composers, and Alan Alda writes several of the scripts, and she gets like a genius cast of people that we think of as the people of the time. Harry Belafonte, Mel Brooks, Carol Channing, like if you think about,
it's just basically every Muppet Show guest.
Yeah, it's the Johnny Carson Show couch. Rita Coolidge, Roberta Flack, Rosie Greer, who was at the time one of those football players that had transitioned to being a part
TV,
of the culture.
TV guest, guy.
He was enormous.
There's clearly an attempt to make sure people of color are represented here.
Yep,
and just in those last four names,
Dustin Hoffman, a teenage Michael Jackson. Chris Christopherson, because he was the most beautiful man in the world at the time. Tom Smothers, Dionne Warwick, like very diverse. And they wrote like the arc of a television show in the form of skits. And when I told you we were going to do this show, you were like, I know every skit.
I can sing those songs right now.
Yeah.
People with children, busy with children, and things that they do. There are a lot of things, a lot of mommies, and a lot of daddies
can do.
What's the song that Roberta Flack and Michael Jackson sing? When I get older, will I be a something? Will I be big and strong? I don't know that song.
Yeah, when I grow up. It was originally, on the record, it was performed by Diana Ross.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's Roberta Flack on the show, right?
Roberta Flack and Michael Jackson
duet.
But if
we go up, do you think we'll see that you're still like you and you're still like me? They're incredibly catchy little numbers.
What's crazy is when I rewatched it, you know, I remember all the bits and I remember it all. But when it came to When We Grow Up and it started and I was like, oh, this song. And then when it got to the chorus, I just burst into tears, and I sat and just couldn't control I cried through the whole song, because that hook, I don't think I had heard since I was 6 years old, 5 or 6 years old.
But it's weird how good your mind is at that age at remembering
music,
the songs you like.
And it was so threaded into my soul that the idea, you know, that because of the messages of this show, that we were free to be us, and that, you know, and the skits, in particular, the skits where Marlo Thomas and Mel Brooks are two baby Muppets in a nursery. They've just been born, and the show starts with them arguing about who's a boy and who's a girl. And as a 5-year-old, that was so delightful, and so
It felt a little transgressive.
It did. It was.
Is there some moment where they look down and then they realize they're boys and girls?
They go to because Mel Brooks is convinced he's a girl and he's convinced that Marlo Thomas is a boy. Although she's arguing like, I'm not so sure about that. Like, it could be anything. I want to be a.
See, there's your trans character.
Yeah, I want to be a steamship driver.
Trans icon Mel Brooks.
But then the nurse comes to change their diapers and she's like, I'm a girl, and he's like, I'm a boy.
Sorry.
It was so to me as a little kid, just like rolling on the floor laughing at these babies talking about who is a girl and who is a boy, but also the message that that's not a thing you would know until you looked in your pants. It's not a thing because she wasn't born to be a housewife. She wanted to be a construction worker, and he liked dolls and singing and lace or whatever.
It's a weird kind of essentialism about babies.
It was. But those two, the babies are the reoccurring theme throughout the show. And they kind of come in that kind of like the old men in the Muppets, right? They come in between skits and have a little bit.
Yeah, that's the through line.
But so then it goes and there's songs. Harry Belafonte comes out and sings. There's storytelling. There's the,
isn't there one that's actually, Dustin Hoffman is reading a book to some kids.
Yeah. Although he does compositions by Jules Siegel.
There's a cartoon interlude, this is not on the record, but about the myth of Atalanta winning a race because she can be faster than the boys.
And that's a long segment, and it's an animated segment where the king, her father, is like, whoever wins the race gets the right to marry my daughter. And she's like, she ends up winning the race. And she's like, nobody gets to marry me. I'm going to see the world.
And they've got some cover because this feminist story is also 4,000 years old.
Right, a Greek story. Yeah. And it turns out the boy that co-won the race with her, because she didn't win it. They crossed the finish line at the same moment. But he's like, I won't marry you unless you want to marry me. And, you know, it's kind of, you see the male ally and the powerful girl in the same moment.
It is kind of, I'd forgotten they tie.
They tie.
Maybe it was not tenable in 1970 whatever to have.
I'm not familiar enough with the Greek myth to know how it played out, but yeah, it was
in the myth a guy actually wins her.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a guy even though she's faster than him, he tricks her with trickery. The gods help him get married to her.
So this was an example, and there are a ton of them in the show where the man gets the opportunity to be the ally, be a good guy. There really aren't
You don't see a lot of retrograde male behavior
there, and that's kind of a nice thing about it. The show is not focusing on bad male archetypes; it's just presenting good ones. One of the only ones is in the skit about how William wants a doll.
Oh yeah,
and William's dad just can't understand why William wants a doll, and he buys him a baseball bat, and he buys him a golf clubs or whatever, and he just can't, he's just like, what? And the other kids in William Wants a Doll do this William Wants a Doll schoolyard taunt that I think we actually used on the schoolyard.
Oh, you would actually, you turned William Wants a Doll against your,
I think William Wants a Doll became a thing where it was just like, and they do use the word sissy multiple times. At one point, the principal of the school puts his arm around William and says, you know, it's not that wanting a doll is sissy. It's that being afraid to have a doll is sissy. It's like, sissy is still the thing you don't want to do. And sissy comes up in another.
I'm going to be confident enough to have a doll.
I'm not sissy. And it ends up that he wants a doll not because he wants to be a mommy, but it's his grandmother who says he's trying to practice to be a good dad. And he gets a doll and he combs its hair and he bathes it and he changes it.
So what starts out as like a nice queer parable actually becomes a little more Eisenhower era at the end.
Well, and I think there are lots of examples of young queer kids that point to that moment, that are my age,
yeah,
that point to that moment as like the first sign that it was okay.
At least they saw someone like them.
Yeah, like,
even if at the end there's a sentence of, because then you can have a baby with your wife who is a girl.
And I think probably like that was as far as anybody could imagine going and talking to a kid at that age.
Apparently ABC did not like that sketch because they thought it seemed gay.
A little sissy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Grant, are you familiar with Mint Mobile, the cell phone service company?
Oh, am I ever? Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah, I am.
Have you used Mint Mobile, or do you know people that are using their service?
You know, I know many that are using their service, and it's been very interesting to me. I haven't made the switch yet, but I'm in a contract, but I think I might be about ready to make a switch.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but Mint Mobile plans are only $15 a month, and it's kind of natural to ask, what's the catch? Well, Grant, there isn't a catch. There are no gimmicks, no gotchas. Just unlimited talk, text, and data, fast, reliable coverage on the nation's largest 5G network, and an award-winning care team. All of that for only $15 a month.
That's quite a deal.
It really is. And you've got two kids. Do they have cell phones?
Only one of them. Only one of them has been co-opted into the world of cell phones. But, you know, soon enough, I will have two.
Well, on behalf of the one that has a cell phone, they can bring their current phone and current number. So you don't need to buy a new phone. You don't need to change any of your deets. You choose from a 3, 6, or 12-month plan, and then goodbye to your monthly bill.
Right. Well, it would be unk to have to change your number. I think that's what the kids say. So,
oh my God, it would be so unk. So in order to not be unk, here's how you get your new wireless plan for $15 a month. You go to mintmobile.com/omnibus. That's mintmobile.com/omnibus. I know you know to put the /omnibus on there. You'll cut your wireless bill to $15 a month. Just go to mintmobile.com/omnibus, Grant. That's it. There's no catch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. And then, very famously, Rosie Grier, this enormous football player, you know, the big black guy, sings a song about boys being able to cry.
It's all right to cry. Crying takes the sad out of you. Did you know that? Crying takes the sad out of you?
It doesn't
it's
for me.
It's all right to cry.
it just exacerbates the sad.
It then might make you feel better, I think he says.
I'm not so sure, but yeah, I guess.
If I remember right, it looks like a 70s variety show. He's on some kind of a mylar stage.
He's
sort
sitting
of loose
on a
side
stool,
stage.
Yeah.
But it's like transparent, so you can kind of see from beneath him. And
it was, I mean, when you watch it now, it's like, well, this isn't really a very good song or a good rendition of it. But at the time, it was like an earthquake in terms of...
He's a pro athlete.
He's the most manly of the manly, and he's saying it's okay to cry.
But I feel like he did have a brand where he's like, also, I knit. Like, if you saw him in an American Express commercial, that was part of his thing.
I mean, Rosie Grier actually published a book in 73 called Rosie Grier's Needlepoint for Men.
There we go.
So he was for sure like, he was on the... He played for the New York Giants, he played for the LA Rams. And then, weirdly, I didn't know this... Did you know he was a bodyguard for RFK? And he's the one...
I can
one,
see why you'd leave that off your resume.
He's the one that actually got the gun out of Sirhan Sirhan's hand.
And this is after his NFL career?
After his NFL career. He was, on that day, he was Ethel Kennedy's guard while
it's
RFK was giving the
celebrity,
speech.
Because he was a big name. It's weird to have celebrity bodyguards.
It is. Huh. But this was a time when celebrities were in politics, if you can imagine such a time.
Well, I mean, in politics is one thing, but like basically de facto Secret Service is a little weird.
Well, what we haven't even talked about yet is that this record came out and was so popular that they made it into a television show starring all of these people. So when we're talking about the television show, it came out a year after the the record, and a book came out with it then. The initial projections were that the record would sell 10,000 copies. It was a kid's record.
Yeah.
But the record went gold and then ultimately went platinum, and I think now is a diamond record.
Wow.
And so the television show got made, and the TV show, when it aired, had a 27, you would know what these things mean, a 27 share.
I think that means literally 27% of households, not people with TV on, but all American households were watching it.
Pretty incredible. It was massive. And the show won an Emmy. Like I say, it became just a fixture of American education and entertainment.
One thing I don't know is, and maybe you'll tell me, is was there backlash at the time? Certainly social conservatives existed then, even if the religious right hadn't really got its act together. I'm sure there were a lot of people who would be happy to say, actually, women should be in the home and godless Marlo Thomas shouldn't be putting this on TV. Was there pushback?
There was a ton of pushback, you know, and one of the things was that all the proceeds went to the brand new Ms. Foundation for Women that was started as an enterprise that Ms. Magazine was it was embedded in the Ms. Foundation. The idea being that all of the proceeds of Ms., the magazine, and Free to Be You and Me and many other things besides would go into scholarship programs, grant writing. The Ms. Foundation would become like a major foundation supporting women's, not just rights, but, you know, women in business and culture. And I think as time went on, they realized that making a magazine run at all requires all of the money.
The margins are very thin.
And so they separated Ms. Magazine.
You can't also be reading grants.
No, that's right. And so the Ms. Foundation and Ms. Magazine kind of became separate enterprises. But the Ms. Foundation is what is, you know, and Gloria Steinem at the time was a very controversial figure.
So just this idea that Gloria Steinem's in your kids' classrooms and on ABC TV telling your boys to cry with their dolls. Was that,
so
were there a bunch of
Steinem wasn't in the in
William
the
Sapphire
show.
Columns about this? Or,
yeah, there, you know what I mean? there was a sense then, as probably we've come full circle then as now, that some of these were pretty subversive ideas. We were living in a culture that was post-civil rights.
I'm sure they were getting letters from the South still.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. But Marlo Thomas then in 72, this is before even this was after the record, but before the TV show came out, she was the California delegate to the Democratic Convention in 72. So she was a national figure, and this is, I think, like we were talking before, the Democratic Party embraced and encompassed all of these causes as part of just the fundamental platform. Marlo Thomas then, you know, this became a franchise, right? There are a few other...
Is that true? Are there spinoffs? I don't know anything but the original.
Not a ton.
Did ABC want a sequel?
One came out in the 80s, but it because there was a book, because there was an album, because this was a show that where the music became kind of ingrained, it was obviously a leaping off point for Schoolhouse Rock, which felt very much like it. If you think about The Electric Company as a television show, it feels like an extension of Free to Be You and Me.
I just found out that the puppet babies were operated by Wayland Flowers of Wayland Flowers and Madam Fame.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and you can really see although they're voiced by Mel Brooks, can really see him doing his Madam kind of big mouth, wah, the kind of Fozzie Bear.
I wonder what was the 80s one? What does this look like on Coke? Free to Be You and Me sequel. I'm very interested. Free to Be a Family. Oh, I remember this.
Free to Be a Family.
I feel like I saw this in video stores, except the cast is all so 80s. It's like, we've got Penn and Teller and John Bon Jovi.
Not quite as good. Marlo Thomas became a treasured American, and continued to be, as you say, the spokesperson for St. Jude.
Still alive, right?
She's alive even now, but she had a kind of third celebrity act when she met and fell in love with Phil Donahue. She was a guest on his show, coming on talking about the Ms. Foundation, and they looked at each other across their...
She's like, this is the perfect thoughtful man that I tried to manifest with my record.
Yeah, you couldn't have picked a more a more progressive man. And they, against all odds, like we said, she was stepmother to his five sons. They were married for 44 years until his death in 2024. She's still alive, 88 years old. In 2014, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Obama. Highest civilian award.
I'm guessing President Obama was raised on Free to Be You and Me. I would not.
Certainly.
I would not be surprised.
He was born in 61, so he would have been 10.
Yeah.
And that would have been... Between 5 and 12, probably, is everybody between 5 and 12 at that point. And then, of course, all the kids in the 70s who are younger who watch this on film strip.
Yeah, it was still in video stores. You know, like, I think 80s kids of all stripes would have seen Free to Be You, Man. I don't know when that dimmed.
I showed it to my daughter, but by then it's crazy because looking at it, it looks like all the kids in the show, when Marlo Thomas is interviewing the five-year-olds, they're me, right? They're exactly, they're the kids in my school.
They found my bowl cut and put it on TV.
The shirts they're wearing are the shirts that I wore. And so, yeah, generationally, if you watch it, you can't help but feel like at one level... Gen X was already, the boomers were already there. Second generation feminism was a boomer product, and it already knew 8 out of 10 of the major themes that we still would think of as progressive politics today. And they were very confident in them and very ready to teach a generation of kids these themes. And very confident that that would produce a future that was equitable and that equality would be a no-brainer to this generation of kids because it was so, that it was just going to be in the water.
What we need is a new Free to Be You and Me, the new, like, kind of post-Trump. I don't know who is that.
Well, I don't know. And the thing is, all of the issues are still the same and the messages would be mostly the same. So there isn't a new one. There's just the old one. We just need to go back and all watch Free to Be You and Me.
Do we have to like CGI Sabrina Carpenter into it or anything?
I hope not. I mean, don't get mad about the fact that it isn't from 50 years later because it's pretty progressive.
The music's going to still sound good.
Yes.
Maybe you can just, Photoshop Charles Barkley in next to Rosie Grier.
Roberta Flack and Michael Jackson, if it doesn't make you cry, I don't know what will.
And that concludes Free to Be You and Me, entry 499.1C1111, certificate number 36926, in the omnibus. Look for your fellow futurelings online, on Reddit. There's a Discord at Omnibus Project on Instagram. Just look for the futurelings. They'll know what to do. YouTube.com is where you'll find the show's video content. So go to youtube.com/@theomnibusproject. If you have ideas for Omnibus, that's something you can submit. Go to omnibusproject.com/submit. Now you can send physical objects to the new P.O. Box. John just gave me the address, so I get this right. 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084. That's in right here in Burien, Washington. B-U-R-I-E-N. 98166-9998. I have some other stuff that I got in the old P.O. box that I never showed you.
What do you got there?
Well, all the Christmas cards that came. The Gettys say Merry Christmas. So do the Comistras. I don't know if I'm saying that right. I apologize.
Oh, we got all the Christmas cards. That's sweet. I mean, it's that makes sense.
It is May.
Yeah, but they would have been mailed right about the time.
Here's still more. A Bob's Burgers themed one from the Donahues. Mm-hmm. Oh, and an animated version of them on the back.
Merry Christmas.
We're still getting stuff from the Center for Land Use Interpretation.
That's nice.
Some postcards to learn and share.
Learn and grow.
A thank you card from... Oh, Zach, wishing me farewell from the Library of Congress. He's the one that would often send us stuff published by the Library of Congress's in-house publishing arm, many of which I have enjoyed.
Yeah, we'll be hearing from Zach again, I think.
Zach's the one. Oh, is he on your list?
Yeah, we'll find out.
He definitely wants to give us a tour if we're ever in D.C. That's nice. Thank you, Zach. And a mail. This maybe is a mail truck. Did he make this? He must have found a mail truck themed card.
That's pretty great.
Good job, Zach. And then a postcard from Ken John and guest host Andrew says. Oh, he didn't. He had a postcard all set to go to the old PO box and then forgot to send it. So even though he knows it's out of date, he sends this on and wishes many goods and cheese to the new omnibus format. I hope you're still enjoying it.
Very nice.
Andrew. And then you got a poster to the new
PO Box. Well, yeah, we opened this poster a while back, but now we're actually going to open it and pull it out.
It's whatever it is, it's big.
Big poster.
It's multiple pages. Oh, it's multiple Edward Gorey. Oh, wow. It's a, is it an omnibus take on Gashly Crumb Tinies? It's a full version of Edward Gorey's Ash Gashly Crumb Tinies with omnibus references. Oh, this is really good.
Are there two of them, or is that just a backing?
Apparently, this is somebody else who meant to send this a long time ago and had to update the letter that she had ready to go. Laura from Portland sends us the omnibus tinies, something she started writing before the pandemic.
What?
And she used other Gorey drawings, Edward Gorey drawings, to kind of assemblage style, Rauschenberg style, collaged into an alphabet of omnibus references. She realizes there maybe is a bit of a cheat. She can only find one place where you made fun of Windsor, Canada, but apparently used that one.
Here, let me see it.
Here is the cover letter, and are there two? There are. It begins with A for Alaska, the state John is from. B is for Bell, dinged for a Ken pun.
Hey, don't crumple mine.
I'll take that one.
Crumpler.
C is for cursive, Gen Z does not know. D for defenestration, bouncing checks out a window. This is a good time. E is for Everest, strewn with corpses and debris. F is for frontier, that old West history. Laura, this is amazing, amazing work.
Wow, and that's cool.
It name checks many omnibus favorites like mail trucks.
H is for Hitler in every other entry.
What does that even rhyme with? G is for Gatsby novel lacking M-E. What, we have washing bears, we have UFOs. W is for Windsor.
That's really marvelous.
We need to, if you are an omnibus listener who remembers when Windsor, it's for the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, the bridge, which was in the news. I was surprised we didn't get an addenda letter about the bridge.
I think we got some. Y is for Yngwie Malmsteen, of course. I'm a big fan of the original Gashly Crumb Tinies. You probably are too.
Yes, right? I am. I have a first edition, actually.
Show off. But I never dreamed of being immortalized in an omnibus version. Laura, I'm so glad I happened to be here this week when Laura's
poster. How cool arrived. Is that?
Had you already? Work. You had not looked at this.
No, I hadn't looked at it. I hadn't popped
it. I'm going to take this home to show the fam.
I'm going to put it on the door right there. Thank you, Laura. Tape it on the door.
And of course, the thing you have to know about Omnibus is that I'm the only one here working for free. The show only exists because of the support of listeners like you. And if you're a listener who enjoys Omnibus but has not joined the Patreon community, why not go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and check that out? There is a treasure trove of perks, years of photos, show notes, outtakes, studio shots, mail. There's the get to know you. That's probably the best perk right now, right? Is that there's a half hour or so of additional omnibus content every week.
Yeah,
of John shooting the breeze with the co-host.
That's just chatty and fun, and we learn so much about our co-hosts. We learned so much about you in the half hour we talked.
We mostly talked about Ukraine.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's my passion.
Yeah, we learned about you by how wonderfully you listened to me talk about Ukraine.
A lot of people think you're the one that cares about land wars on the borders of the former Soviet Union. But no, that's my passion. That's why we hang out, so I can hear you talk about that. Thank you to all our supporters. I'm still, even though I'm an emeritus host, I'm still very much part of the Omnibus team here.
Executive and producer.
Love talking to John about what's going on with the show.
Right.
And I actually read quite a bit about the new episodes, even though I rarely listen to podcasts. I do always see, oh, hey, they're doing a show about WWE post-kayfabe era. And I'm filled with love once again for everything Omnibus can be.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.